We'll hear argument now in the case of United States against Kaiser. Mr. Anderson.
May it please the Court, I'm Kent Anderson with the Federal Public Defender's Office of the Central District of Illinois, representing Appellant Roy Mosley. Mr. Mosley, in the court below, moved to withdraw his plea based on his conspiracy to possess, intent to distribute controlled substances, and he based the motion on his attorney's conflict of interest due to the fact that one of his two attorneys, Mr. Richard Mottweiler, represented two other defendants in state court who were charged with some of the same drugs, in connection with some of the same drugs Mr. Mosley was charged with. The district court abused its discretion when it denied Mr. Mosley's motion. The court appears to have found that Mr. Mosley impliedly waived his right to conflict-free counsel. However, that can't be true because no one discussed the nature of the conflict or the specific problems involved in joint representation with Mr. Mosley. And this court and others have found that such a discussion is necessary for there to be a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of the right to conflict-free counsel. Mr. Mottweiler testified he didn't discuss the conflict with Mr. Mosley and thought there wasn't one. Mr. Miller testified he didn't think Mottweiler viewed the problem as significant. However, he didn't even know what the conflict was, so there couldn't have been much discussion in his presence. This court should not require Mr. Mosley to know more than his attorneys who are blind to their own conflict. Now, as to the rest of the issues regarding conflict of interest, meaningful appellate review is impossible because the court didn't determine whether Mr. Mottweiler had an actual conflict of interest or if there was an adverse effect. However, if the court disagrees and finds that meaningful appellate review is possible, the district court is still wrong. Because Mr. Mottweiler had an actual conflict, one or more of his clients could have cooperated and testified against the others. As the Ninth Circuit has found, cooperation has become a crucial aspect of plea bargaining in the federal system. And in this case, Mr. Mosley actually did proffer once and implicated Ira McDaniel, one of Mr. Mottweiler's other clients. And Mr. McDaniel and Ruben Contreras, Mr. Mottweiler's third client, were both potential government witnesses at a trial, according to prosecutor Brian Ellis. Mr. Milner thought that they had already implicated Arthur and Watisse Bell, that actually were Mr. Mosley's brother and son, respectively. This court has found that there's an actual conflict and the interest conflict with respect to certain choices, even if the choices do not actually conflict. And that's because the conflict may have been the reason the choices made by the defendants don't conflict with the interests of other defendants. Now, several other courts found an actual conflict of interest in circumstances similar to this case. It's true that Mr. Mottweiler testified he didn't think he had an actual conflict and it didn't affect his representation. However, as the Fifth Circuit has found, after-the-fact testimony by a conflicted lawyer is not helpful. Because of the tendency, either subconsciously or consciously, to rationalize past conduct. Now, sometimes independent counsel can cure the problem with the conflict by other counsel, but that wasn't the case here. In contrast, Mr. Milner was infected with Mr. Mottweiler's conflict of interest. Mr. Mottweiler remained deeply involved in the case throughout until Mr. Mosley pled guilty. He substituted into the case, substituted out, and then substituted back in as co-counsel with Mr. Milner. He filed discovery motions initially. He talked to Mr. Mosley several times, both when he was and when he wasn't counsel of record. And he assisted in the investigation for Mr. Mosley. Perhaps most importantly, both Mr. Mottweiler and Mr. Milner advised Mr. Mosley to plead guilty. Therefore, this court should reverse and remand for additional factual finding or an alternative order that Mr. Mosley be allowed to withdraw his plea or be resentenced as if he had cooperated, if the court can determine what that would be. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Counsel for the Prosecution. My name is Robert Kronkowitz, and I represent Ronnie Barlow. Mr. Barlow presents for your consideration this morning one issue, and that is the issue surrounding his being taken into custody on October 27, 1999. That was the evening. Six Chicago policemen were sitting around, and these were policemen who were deputized to help federal authorities in a federal drug investigation. They were sitting around eating donuts, and one of them said, "What are we going to do tonight?" Someone else said, "What do you say we talk to Barlow?" Someone said, "That's a good idea," and talked to him they did. He was approached, he was handcuffed, he was taken to a suburban police station, in an interrogation room, six Chicago police officers, one assistant U.S. attorney. Let's talk. It is Barlow's position that no legal arrest occurred that evening, and that his claimed confession, which was the product of that encounter, was the product of coercion. Now, the government's position is not so fast. Any custodial interrogation is inherently coercive, and they're relying on your decision in Trigg. It is our position that that misses the point. We're not talking about coercion as a matter of law, but rather here as a matter of fact. Any promises of benefits, any promises of leniency, direct or implied, are inherently coercive. Any improper inducement,
I don't understand that argument. You mean if a defendant pleads guilty in exchange for some promise of lenience, dismissal of charges, that's inherently coercive and hence involuntary and hence it has to be set aside?
No, I'm...
So you don't mean a promise of lenience is inherently coercive?
Because the
entire operation of the criminal justice system depends on the opposite premise.
No, I'm talking about the situation well before charge or indictment. When a gentleman is then...
It's all the same. If it's inherently coercive, it's inherently coercive.
Judge, with all due respect, I must disagree. You're confronted by police. You were going about your business that evening, committing no crime. And in the words of Mr. Ellis, shows him a guidelines chart and says, "You're off the chart, fella. Well, now you can do yourself some good." There is a promise of some benefit. Question is, if the person thinks he's getting a benefit and then starts to say things that are claimed to incriminate him, is that a reliable statement? Is that statement the product of unfair coercion or is it not? It is our position that it is. When people plead guilty in court, by that time they've had the benefit of counsel, they're represented by counsel. We give them the strengths of their cases, we give them the weaknesses of their cases, we advise as to what the best course of conduct is, and typically they follow our advice. Certainly no one wants to plead guilty, no one wants to go to jail. I would dare say that most people don't want to make confessions. But if that confession is, let me just go back to the Tingle case, cited in our brief. They tell the woman, "We've got the goods on you in effect, and lady, you're not going to be seeing your children for some time." The Ninth Circuit found that that comment made to Mrs. Tingle was inherently coercive. Okay? Here, telling Mr. Barlow,
"If you were to try to rely on Seventh Circuit cases, which ones would you choose?"
Probably the Foxworth case, and that goes to the arrest situation. That was the only Seventh Circuit case I could find, either in my brief or in Appellee's brief, that directly addressed the issues before this court. I'll get to that in just, well, let me get to it now. The issue is, the government says we have probable cause to arrest this fellow. We have probable cause. It goes back 2 years, it goes back 3 months, it goes back whatever. And once we have that probable cause because some co-conspirator, alleged co-conspirator, said something, we can take an American into custody anytime we want. That's their position.
Counsel, you just moved from inherent coercion to probable cause to arrest. My question was, what Seventh Circuit case would you rely on for the proposition that a promise of lenience or some discussion of the consequences of confessing is inherently coercive?
Well, I found no case from the Seventh Circuit directly on point with Tingle from the Ninth. You do have the Trigg case, but tried to rob against the defendant, but nevertheless said a custodial interrogation is inherently coercive. But that was what I started out earlier by saying, that it is our position that that is talking about coercion as a matter of law and not coercion as a matter of fact, as we have in our case. I see the white light is on, if I may save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Mr. Willis.
Good morning, Ted. Standish Willis on behalf of Keith Kaiser. We raised a number of issues in our brief. I want to focus on the issue where the trial judge denied our motion for a new trial based on the recantation of their key witness, Solomon Evans. And I say their key witness because Solomon Evans was the only witness that tied Mr. Kaiser to this overall conspiracy. Without his testimony, Mr. Kaiser, that would have been testimony that Mr. Kaiser engaged in drug trafficking with various individuals, but it was Mr. Evans who tied Mr. Kaiser to the conspiracy. So his testimony was critical for the government. Mr. Kaiser was only indicted on count one, the conspiracy count, and that's the count that the jury found him guilty on. After the trial was over, we discovered that Mr. Evans had told probation officer Kelly Rice that essentially he was not involved in the conspiracy in the way he had testified at trial. He said...
Yeah, you might want to get to the district court's findings. The district court found that what Evans told the probation officer was false, and that even if it were true, it would not be a recantation. Is either of those findings clearly erroneous?
I think they are, Judge. And the reason I said is two reasons. One, the recantation was more than the amount of the drugs. The trial judge focused on the 11 to 12 kilograms and concludes that even if the testimony had been 11 to 12 kilograms, since he was charged in indictment with greater than 5 kilograms, he would have been found guilty anyway. That wouldn't make no difference. The focus was the recantation was broader than that. In the recantation, Mr. Evans talked not only about the drug quantity, he talked about his involvement in the leadership. He challenges the testimony of other co-defendants who are cooperated. So his recantation was much broader than the amount, and the judge focuses on the amount only. Secondly, the standard that the judge used is not consistent with the standard announced in the Mazzani case. The judge focuses on, the judge basically says, what if the jury had to recant the testimony that it was 11 to 12 kilograms? What difference would it make? The standard is, what did the jury actually learn in the trial testimony? Not what would they have decided if they knew about the recanted testimony. What they learned in the trial testimony, Mr. Evans said that he trafficked drugs on a regular basis during the 4 years of the conspiracy, 1995 to 1999, that he trafficked in excess of 150 grams of kilos of cocaine, that he was a leader of the conspiracy. That's what the jury learned, and that's why they found Mr. Kaiser guilty. But in his recanted testimony, he backed off of that. He said that the drug trafficking was very difficult, that he wasn't the leader, that he only trafficked 11 to 12 kilograms. Now, I submit to you, had the jury knew that he trafficked 11 to 12 kilograms, the jury may not have found Mr. Kaiser guilty, because the jury would then have to decide, well, given that amount of drugs, you got four or five guys in the conspiracy, then how many, you know, what's the quantity of drugs for each one of them? And it could very well...
What does that have to do with his guilt?
Well, I'm moving to... It has to do with his guilt to the extent that the judge focused on just the quantities, which was, I think, the question you raised. And the answer to that was simply, if the jury had known... the broader picture, which came out in recantation, it would have made a, it would have satisfied a reasonable probability standard.
How? Consistent with what's actually in the statute.
I'm sorry, Judge?
A person who traffics in any detectable amount of cocaine violates the statute. And, of course, any amount greater than 5 years gets you in the maximum possible penalty range. So how would a disagreement about whether the correct amount was 8 kilograms or 12 kilograms or some different amount conceivably be relevant, even?
The disagreement is relevant because Mr. Kaiser was charged and convicted of a conspiracy. And all of those things that I just mentioned, the leadership, the involvement, that goes to the conspiracy. If the jury had decided that he's not guilty of a conspiracy because of his recantation, then that would have made a difference.
No, but how could a dispute about whether the amount is 5, 12, some different number, conceivably bear on any of the questions in the case? Conspiracy is agreement, plain and simple. It has nothing to do with the amount.
And that's our point, exactly. The judge focuses only on the amount. And we're not disputing just the amount. Our argument was more than the amount, Judge. It had to do with the recantation relate to the leadership of the conspiracy, the duration of the conspiracy, the duration of leadership. The judge was erroneous when he
focused on... The duration of the conspiracy has nothing to do with guilt. Person who agrees to distribute drugs is at that moment guilty of the crime of conspiracy, regardless of how long it lasts. Indeed, regardless of whether there is ever a single overt act.
Yeah, that's the red light I was expecting. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ryan.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to address defense counsel's arguments in turn. The district court did not abuse its discretion by refusing to allow Mosley to withdraw his guilty plea based on an alleged conflict of interest. The court found that Mosley had independent, conflict-free counsel in Mr. Milner. Mr. Milner was his lawyer, and Mosley alleges that Milner was tainted because Mr. Mottweiler kept talking with Mr. Mosley, but this argument ignores that Mr. Mottweiler talked with Mr. Mosley, the defendant, at Mr. Mosley's request. And throughout the period of time that Mr. Mosley was going through these proceedings, Mr. Milner was independent, conflict-free counsel. It was only when Mr. Mosley sought a second opinion from Mr. Mottweiler that Mr. Mottweiler became involved and advised him to plead guilty because, indeed, the evidence was overwhelming. Further, the district court developed the record on this particular issue extensively. The district court held a 3-day hearing. Both lawyers testified. Mr. Mosley testified. And then the district court ruled that Milner was independent. Thus, we submit that it was not an abuse of discretion. The second argument that defense counsel makes regards Mr. Barlow's confession. I believe defense counsel's argument is that it was a product of an illegal arrest or coercion. I think it makes sense to go back over the facts of that evening, October 27, 1999. Mr. Barlow was, in fact, arrested, and he was arrested with probable cause. The evidence against Mr. Barlow, as of October 27, 1999, was overwhelming.
Why didn't they get an arrest warrant?
Your Honor, I don't know why they didn't get an arrest warrant. Perhaps it was because the evidence against him was so overwhelming. There was sworn grand jury testimony.
Would have been pretty easy to get an arrest warrant.
that may be the case, Judge. That may be the case.
That's usually what would happen here.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. There was testimony from 3 eyewitnesses, 3 co-conspirators, an undercover tape recording that implicated Mr. Barlow, and a post-arrest confession from a 4th witness, Mr. Alex Michaud. Based on all that evidence, at that point, on the evening of October 27th, they went out and they arrested Mr. Barlow. At this point, Mr. Ellis, the assistant U.S. attorney assigned to the case at that point, administered the Miranda warnings to Mr. Barlow. Indeed, he did tell him. He told him about the evidence against him and showed him the sentencing guidelines and asked if he wanted to cooperate. He did. There's mention made in the briefs, and I believe counsel touched on it briefly, that this interrogation lasted 3 hours. Judge, the facts in the record show that Mr. Barlow talked most of that time. It took him that long to recount his involvement in this very large drug conspiracy. So I would submit that that point, the length of the interview, is irrelevant. Finally, I think the law, and counsel made reference to Johnson v. Trigg, the law is absence of an arrest warrant does not invalidate a confession. Custodial interrogation is permitted as long as Miranda warnings are given. The district court found it. The district court had two hearings in this matter on this particular issue, and the district court found that Mr. Ellis did administer the Miranda warnings. After the Miranda warnings, it was acceptable to continue talking with him, and Mr. Barlow did agree to that, continue talking with the law enforcement officers. A third issue that defense counsel brought up was the motion for a new trial based on a purported recantation by Solomon Evans, the commander of this drug conspiracy. Again, the district court fully developed a record on this issue, and at a January 22, 2002 hearing, probation officer Kelly Rice testified, Evans testified, the commander of the drug conspiracy, and the court issued a written opinion, which can be found at 2002 Westlaw 773561. The district court looked into this extensively, and it was not an abuse of discretion to find that Mr. Evans' statement to the probation officer did not constitute a recantation. They were false. His statements, that, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, they were false when he made them. And the district court found specifically in the opinion that Mr. Evans' testimony before the grand jury and at trial was more credible. For all these reasons, Judge, the government urges the court to affirm the convictions. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ryan. Anything further, Mr. Anderson?
Yes, Your Honor. We'll point out that the court did not find specifically that Mr. Milner was independent. The only thing it found was that he gave excellent representation, whatever that means, and it didn't, in fact, say why that was so. It also does not matter that Mr. Mosley sought Mr. Mottweiler's assistance, since he didn't know the danger that was involved in that, and in fact, every defendant seeks the assistance of a particular attorney unless that attorney is appointed. Would note that at the initial substitution of counsel hearing, when Mr. Ellis raised the problem of the conflict, Mr. Mosley said he was going to talk to Mr. Mottweiler because he didn't know what was going on. And as the evidence later showed, Mr. Mottweiler never told him. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Krankowitz, yes, anything further?
For short points, getting back to the coercion issue, after he left the interrogation room, after he, according to Officer Castro, absolutely agreed to cooperate, he blew the government off for the second time. That is the best evidence of this man's free will. As to tape recordings, they never mentioned a tape recording when one of their stool pigeons called him in 1997, March of 1997, 2 years before this, 2.5 years before, and tried to set up a drug deal with Barlow, mentioning drugs on the recording. Left a message. Barlow never returned the call. When I cross-examined him at trial, did anybody else ever contact you, you know, saying they're responding to this call? No. The best evidence that this man did not say what they claim he said that night. As to the Miranda warnings, the giving of Miranda warnings, they begin the inquiry. They don't end it. Simply because one acknowledges that he is aware of his rights under Miranda doesn't necessarily compel a statement thereafter. I mean, we're trained in the law. We know our Miranda rights. But it doesn't mean we go up and down the hallways in this building blabbing about every wrong or indiscretion we've ever committed. He got his Miranda warnings. He acknowledged them. He said he didn't make any confession. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Willis, anything further? Okay. Thank you very much. And Mr. Willis and Mr. Karankovich, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to your clients and to the court. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.